Chapter 20. It was a mile and a half to Bishopsgate, a painful walk through the London throng, my arm in its sling throbbing at every jolt. Daniel and Minnie strode on as fast as possible, Daniel with a set face, Minnie looking as though she would collapse at any moment. A gust of wind brought another squally shower, nearly casting my cap to the ground. I had donned my best robe and cap, for I guessed I might need to exert some authority at Bishopsgate. Daniel had told me that a friend had arrived at his workshop an hour before to tell him that Adam was standing on top of London Wall, screaming out to the crowds that they must come to God for salvation. He had gone out there and seen his son haranguing a growing crowd. They had come for me because they had nowhere else to turn. I wondered angrily how Adam had escaped from the bedlam. It struck me that this frantic preaching was something new. I had sent Barrack to fetch Guy with a pang of conscience at disturbing him again. Yet he'd come nearer than anyone to communicating with Adam, and if the boy couldn't be got down from that wall, it might be the fire this time. As we walked up All Hallows Street, we heard the murmur of a crowd and shouts of laughter. A moment later, Adam came into view. He was standing on top of the ancient, crumbling city wall, shouting down at the crowd which had gathered 30 feet below. Dressed in his filthy rags, his hair matted and his eyes wild, Adam looked like one of the wild country lunatics who escape their families and hide in inaccessible woods until they die of hunger. He was standing above Wormwood Street, perhaps 50 yards out from Bishopsgate Tower. Somehow, he must have got to the top of the gatehouse and clambered out. It seemed no one had gone out after him. The ancient city wall was wide, but it was crumbling away in many places. Even as I watched, Adam dislodged a large stone with his feet, which crashed down to the crowd.
"Hey there, look out!"
someone cried. Adam almost slipped, but managed somehow to regain his balance.
"You must come to Christ," he bawled at them. "You must! You must ensure you are one of the elect! The end is coming! The Antichrist is here! Please, you must pray!"
I saw Reverend Meaphan in the crowd, his face redder than ever. We shouldered our way over to him. Another cleric was standing beside him, a tall, thin old fellow with a beaky-nosed face and thick white hair, well-combed and clean. How well these radical preachers all seemed to look after their hair, a peacock trait above the sober clothes. Minnie clasped Meaphan's arm.
"Oh, sir, you came!"
Meaphan turned to me and I saw the cleric was frightened. "He has to be got down," he said urgently. "If he's taken, I will be questioned. The whole congregation will."
"And mine," the other cleric said. "I am William Yarrington, rector of the next church to Reverend Meaphan's."
He spoke to me in tones of portentous seriousness, evidently assuming I was a radical sympathiser.
"Our truth, our true faith, is under threat from papists and backsliders as never before. That mad boy should have been kept shut away and secure, with someone to pray with him all the time."
He glared at Meaphan. "He manages enough prayers by himself," I snapped. Yarrington looked me coldly up and down, then turned away. He muttered something that sounded like, "Another unbeliever." I turned to Meaphan. "Have you tried speaking with him?" I asked.
"Yes, yes, I have ordered him down, told him to stop his shouting. I said he could put his parents in danger, but he won't listen."
"If they find us here, if they associate me with him,"
the white-haired cleric muttered and cast his eyes around as though looking for escape, then fixed them again on Adam as the boy cried out that he was suffering for them all, like Jesus on his cross.
"Word we'll get to Bonner soon. He'll be here."
Meaphan shook his head.
"It might be better for everyone if he fell and broke his neck," the other cleric said.
Minnie had broken down again and was sobbing on her husband's breast.
"Do something, sir," Daniel implored me. "Please."
There was a fresh gust of laughter from the crowd. Some wretch had brought a dancing bear to entertain the crowd, and the little Bruin, chained and muzzled and with strips of coloured cloth sewn into its ears, stared at the crowd in fear. Its keeper thwacked it on the nose, called, "Dance!" And the poor creature began to shift from leg to leg. The keeper put his cap on the ground for folk to throw pennies.
"Here!" someone called up to Adam. "You dance too! Come on, give us a dance!"
2 middle-aged men in the robes of the Cutler's Guild were next to me.
"This is blasphemy," one said angrily. "The Common Council should be fetched. He should be imprisoned, punished for this display."
"Someone's gone to Bonner's Palace,"
his fellow said in tones of grim satisfaction.
"He'll be punished all right."
"You are right, brother,"
someone called to Adam from the crowd.
"You have the spirit in you."
The crowd I saw was mostly good-natured, seeing this as a spectacle, a joke. But, as with the costumier's arrests, this could turn nasty. I stepped to the front of the crowd directly underneath Adam and looked up at him. He had paused and was taking deep, whooping breaths. He was, I saw, shivering. If he fainted...
"Adam,"
I called,
"please come down. Your mother is sore upset."
He looked down at me, then shifted his gaze to the crowd.
"The world is ending,"
he yelled.
"The Antichrist is here. If you don't deny Satan and come to Jesus, you'll all burn. Burn!"
"Speak, parrot, speak,"
someone called out mockingly.
"Cure the hunchback's arm like Jesus healed the sick. Give us a miracle."
I felt an angry despair. There was no communicating with Adam. One might as well try talking to a brick wall. None of the hot gospelers listened. They only ranted. And either you took what they said for God's word, or in God's name, they casually condemned you to eternal torment. Adam was mad, but that was where his madness had grown from. The killers too, perhaps. Not only declaring God's bloody verdict, but implementing it too. I clutched my throbbing arm, feeling utterly helpless. There was a murmur behind me. Some men were shouldering their way through the crowd. With a sinking heart, I caught a glimpse of raised pikes. A moment later, Bishop Bonner, in black robes and cap and surrounded by his guards, appeared. The crowd stepped away and he moved through, short and stocky and powerful, leaving me, the kites and Mephon, exposed. The other minister melted into the crowd. Above us, Adam had started declaiming scripture, and I recognized a garbled paraphrase of Revelation.
"The fearful and unbelieving and whoremongers and sorcerers shall have their part in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone."
"Cease that blasphemy!"
Bonner's thunderous roar silenced the crowd and made even Adam pause and blink. Close to, the face under the dark cap was round and jowly, the large dark eyes alive with anger.
"Papist!"
someone in the crowd shouted out. Bonner stared round furiously, but in the close-packed crowd there was no way of telling who had spoken. The bishop turned his furious eyes on me.
"Who are you, lawyer? Are you of his family and you?"
His gaze turned to Mephon, who quailed.
"Oh, I know you, sir. You are a leader of the mad, giddy company of schismatics."
I had heard of Bonner's rages. His anger was fierce and, once roused, did not abate.
"Heretic!"
he shouted in Mephon's face. The cleric flinched, his courage visibly draining.
"It's not his fault, sir,"
Daniel Kite spoke up bravely.
"He was trying to talk Adam down. Our son. He's mad, sir. Stark mad.
God is the judge of all. Jesus will come with sword in hand."
Adam had begun again. Bonner turned to the soldiers.
"You, go up through the gatehouse. Bring him down. If he falls, it'll be no loss."
The soldiers approached the wall, but then paused, staring upward. There was a murmur from the crowd as three figures stepped through an upper window of the gatehouse onto the wall. Guy, Barak, and Piers. They moved slowly along the wall towards Adam. Barak and Piers holding their arms out for balance, but Guy, behind, walking straight, his robe hitched up so his feet wouldn't stumble on the hem. The crowd fell silent. Even the furious Bonner was quiet.
"Come, Adam," Guy called. "Remember me? Remember we talked?"
The boy stared at him foolishly as though wondering how he had appeared there. Barak and Piers were almost next to Adam. They looked at him dubiously. I saw fear in both their set faces. If they tried to grasp Adam, he could bring all three down.
"Why are you doing this?"
Guy asked. To my surprise, Adam answered him.
"I thought I could bring others to God. It would prove I was saved."
"But not all who are saved can be messengers to the world."
Guy waved at the crowd.
"See? Look at those people. You are not strong enough to convert that heathen crowd. It's no shame."
Adam began to cry then, and sank slowly to his knees. Some lumps of old mortar dislodged pattered down on the crowd. Barak and Piers knelt carefully beside him, eased him to his feet, and with difficulty led him back along the wall. They helped get the boy through the window of the gatehouse. Guy stepped in after them. Bonner clicked his fingers and walked toward the gatehouse, the guard following. Daniel and Minnie stepped hesitantly after him. Meefen hesitated a moment, then stepped backwards and disappeared into the crowd. I watched him go. Cowardice, or the realization that his presence now would only anger Bonner. Then I tensed. I felt someone watching me, caught the merest glimpse out of the corner of my eye. Someone with a beard. I whirled round. I saw a figure turn away into the crowd, a glimpse of a brown doublet. My heart thumped. Was it him? Following again? I stood rooted to the spot, realizing my anxiety for Adam had made me careless.
"Master Shardlake, please help us!"
It was Minnie Kite's voice. I turned back to her. Adam had emerged from the gatehouse onto the street. Guy and Barak each held one of his arms, for he was trying to drop to the ground again. His eyes were closed, and his lips moved in silent prayer. The gatekeeper followed, looking anxiously at the bishop. Bonner planted himself in front of Adam, arms akimbo.
"This is a fine sight," he thundered. "What did you think you were doing, boy?"
Adam ignored him, his eyes on the ground, praying even now. Bonner reddened.
"You had better answer, boy preacher, or you'll find yourself in a fire like Meekins."
"I don't know how we got up there," the gatekeeper said. "He must have sneaked up through the house. On my oath, sir, I don't know how he did it unless he's a sorcerer and can make himself invisible."
Bonner snorted.
"Slave of the Roman harlot,"
someone shouted out from the crowd. Bonner turned again, frowning mightily.
"Traitor!"
someone else called out. This time there was a murmur of approval from the crowd. The soldiers took a firm hold on their pikes. The mood was beginning to turn. Daniel and Minnie had been looking on helplessly, an expression of mingled fear and distaste in Daniel's eyes as he stared at Bonner. Minnie, though, stepped forward. She fell on her knees before Bonner grasped the hem of his robe.
"Please, sir," she said. "My son is mad. Sick in his mind. The Privy Council sent him to the Bedlam. He must have escaped. He can be sore cunning despite his scattered wits."
Bonner was quite unmoved.
"I heard of that decision. Bishop Gardiner told me. The Privy Council was wrong. This display shows your son to be a wild heretic.
He glared round at us.
I will shortly make matters so hot for you people you will wish yourselves gathered into God.
He stared at Adam, his expression twisted with distaste.
I shall begin with this slavering creature.
He looked round defiantly at the crowd. Whatever else, Bishop Bonner didn't lack courage. I took a deep breath and stepped forward.
Sir, he is mad, I said urgently. I waved at Guy. This man is his doctor. He will certify it. I have been unhappy with the boy's security, his care at the Bedlam. The matter is before the Court of Requests.
I spoke loudly enough for the crowd to hear it. There was a constant murmuring now. Bonner looked curiously at Guy.
So, you are Dr. Moulton, he said. I've heard of you. The ex-monk. Yes, my lord. I heard you were a sound man among the physicians, Bonner said. Why are you working with these heretics?
Guy was at his diplomatic best.
The Privy Council decided he was mad, my lord, not a heretic. I believe he is indeed mad, and I hope he may be cured. Brought to his right thinking, he added meaningfully.
One of the guards looked over the murmuring crowd, then leaned forward and whispered something to Bonner. He looked over at the crowd, then back at Guy and me.
Very well, he said. But I shall keep myself informed on his progress. He turned to me. As for you, lawyer, make sure he's kept safely locked up. I might not be so accommodating next time.
He gave me a stern nod and walked away. The soldiers followed.
Well done, I breathed to Guy.
He gave me a somber look.
I think he realized that if he were to burn a boy a doctor had certified mad, London would be even more against him than it was with Meekins. But he won't forget, Matthew. Adam must be kept secure. Are we taking him back to the Bedlam?
Barrack asked. Yes. Come on, it's a short walk. Let's see what Keeper Shorms has to say, I added grimly. Piers, who had hung back during the conversation with Bonner, now stepped forward and took Adam's arm, Barrack taking the other. We set off, the crowd staring after us, sorry to be deprived of their entertainment. Daniel and Minnie followed behind. They made no effort to talk to their son. They knew it would be useless. The long, low building that housed the Bedlam presented its usual bland face to the world. I knocked on the door and it was opened by the woman Ellen. She had cast off her coif and her dark hair was wild, her expression frightened. When she saw Adam, her face flooded with relief.
Oh, God's mercy, you have him! Where was he?
Preaching to the multitude from the top of London Wall. A group of anxious faces stared from the doorway of the parlour, including the woman who had exposed herself on my last visit.
Oh, Jesus!
Ellen leaned against the wall.
I knew Adam would make another exhibition.
Where is Shorms?
Gone out, sir. I'm here alone with the patients. One of the underkeepers is ill, sir. The other visiting his family in Kent. Master Shorm said he had to go out and he took our third keeper, Lehman, with him. I had 30 people to look after. I thought Adam was safe. I thought he was chained. He must have got out of the window. I came to his cell and he was gone.
Let's get him back in his room. At Ellen's directions, Barrack and Piers dragged Adam, still a muttering deadweight, to the open door of his chamber. Daniel and Minnie followed with Guy. I turned to Ellen.
So, Shorm's left you alone?
Yes, sir.
She hesitated, then said quickly,
I think he did it on purpose. I think he left Adam unchained so he would get out. He is the only one with keys to the chains.
When did you find Adam was gone?
An hour ago.
But didn't you raise the alarm? I frowned, puzzled. Why had someone as conscientious as Ellen done nothing? She reddened and lowered her voice to a whisper.
I may not go out.
She wrung her hands together, the gesture somehow full of the most terrible anxiety.
I didn't know what to do. The other patients were afraid. I think Shawms wanted Adam arrested and dealt with as a heretic. He wanted him out. And I'd be blamed for letting him go. Oh, he's a cruel man. A savage.
But why, Ellen? When you told me before you could never leave the Bedlam, I didn't realise you meant you couldn't leave the building. Why?
Don't ask me, sir.
She gave me a desperate, pleading look. I began to wonder if this woman had perhaps done something terrible, that perhaps she was kept from leaving by order of the court. But then why was she given charge of the patients? The main door opened and Shawms entered, another keeper at his side. When he saw me, he smiled wickedly.
Good day, Master Lawyer. How's your charge?
Safe in his cell, I answered grimly, with his parents and his doctor.
Oh.
Shawms' face fell. He got out, as you planned, but we got him back safe. I stepped up to him.
Now, sir. Listen to me. Your heartless plan to let him escape and blame this poor woman is discovered. I will raise what you've done with Archbishop Cranmer if anything like this happens again.
His eyes widened.
Yes, I am the Archbishop's man.
Do you understand? He gave me a savage look.
I don't know how he got out,
he muttered. The other keeper, meanwhile, backed away and disappeared.
You are a brute! A brute!
It was Minnie's voice. She and Daniel had appeared in the doorway of Adam's cell. Behind them, I saw Barrack looking grim, but Piers, just behind him, was smiling slightly. He was enjoying this. So take care, Master Keeper. I looked at Ellen. And don't take it out on her. I don't know what hold you have on her that she can't go out, but you won't make her your scapegoat.
Shawms laughed then, throatily. Me got a hold on her? Is that what she told you?
She told me nothing.
I bet she didn't.
He laughed again, gave Ellen a look of cruel amusement, then stared round at the parlour doorway.
Come on, you lot. There's been enough spectacle for one day.
The patients retreated before his advance, and Ellen flitted quickly past me, vanishing up the stairs. With a sigh, I turned back to Daniel and Minnie standing outside Adam's door.
The doctor asked us to come out while he talked to Adam, Daniel said. There's no hope for him, is there? With Bonner after him now.
The big man's whole body seemed to sag.
God help me. Out there I half wished Adam would fall, end his suffering.
No, Daniel, no,
Minnie said fiercely.
He is our son.
Even Reverend Meaphan abandoned us.
I will not, I said. The big stonemason nodded, but his body still slumped hopelessly. Shawms reappeared, dangling his big bunch of keys.
He'd better be chained up again, he said grimly.
Must he, sir?
Minnie asked me.
If he's not to escape again, I fear so.
Shawms went into the cell. There was a metallic clinking, then Barrack and Piers came out with the keeper.
We'll leave you,
Barrack said.
You should go home with that arm.
Aye, we can look for those people tomorrow.
I chose my words carefully under Piers' curious eye. It struck me all at once that he was like a bird, a curious opportunistic predator in bright plumage. They walked off, Barrack striding out firmly ahead, avoiding the company of the apprentice. Inside the cell, Guy was kneeling face to face with Adam, who had squeezed himself into a corner once again. Somehow he had once more gained the boy's attention, was whispering to him in soft tones. I stood watching.
"Did you really think if you converted people you might be saved?" Guy was asking.
"Yes,"
a whisper.
"But I was wrong. How could I save them if I'm not saved myself?"
"The Dark Angel told you that you were not saved. When did he tell you that?"
"It was in a dream, after I sinned."
"How did you sin?"
"No."
Adam squeezed his eyes shut.
"No. I've sinned in all ways. No."
"All right."
Guy laid a hand on his shoulder as the boy gave one of his dreadful, wrenching sighs.
"You must be tired, Adam, after all that running and climbing."
"Tiredness doesn't matter," Adam muttered. "I have to pray."
"But tiredness saps the concentration. How can you pray well, then, or listen to God? Sometimes it's effortful to listen to Him."
"And what if you had fallen from that wall? You would have no more chance to pray."
"I was afraid. I did feel I might fall. It was such a long way down."
And with those three sentences, the first I had heard from him that related to the real world, Adam's face seemed to clear, to slip into the lineaments of an ordinary boy, if a terrified one.
"I was afraid too, when I got up there," Guy said. "You step out on the wall and your head reels."
To my amazement, Adam smiled, a tiny watery smile.
"Yes, it does."
Then he frowned, checking himself.
"I have to pray,"
he said. "No, not now. You're too tired. With sleep and some food later, you will pray better. Do not go to God too tired and weak to attend to him."
Guy leaned forward, his brown eyes boring into Adam's.
"There is still time. Still time to be saved. But sleep now. Sleep. Come. Your eyes are closing."
The boy's eyelids fluttered.
"Closing. Sleep. Sleep."
He took Adam's shoulders and gently laid him on the floor. The boy didn't resist. He was already asleep. Guy rose, wincing as his joints cracked. Adam didn't stir.
"That was remarkable," I said to Guy.
"It was easy. He was completely exhausted."
He looked at me.
"You too look tired to death, Matthew. And pale. How was your arm?"
"Sore. I should go to Daniel and Minnie."
Guy laid a hand on my arm.
"I am worried about you, Matthew. All this is affecting you, this other matter."
"He was there, Guy, today in the crowd. The killer. I only caught a merest glimpse, but it was him."
"I know. He taunts me. I'm too weak for this,"
I burst out savagely.
"No. You will press on. I know you."
He spoke the words in a tone that was half comforting and half bleak. He looked sad.
"It's Roger's funeral tomorrow afternoon. Dorothy has sent me a note of the time. You should go home now. Rest that arm."
"I know. Yet I fear that he'll strike again soon." I paused, then went on. "This is affecting me, Guy. Not like Harsnett, who thinks we're dealing with a man possessed. Not like Barrack, who's never come across the like of this before and is frightened, thrashing about for an answer. It's the horror of it. It seems to seep into my bones somehow. Oh, I was content before Roger was murdered, content for the first time in years. And now
I shook my head. I think you're right about what he is, Guy. This is some strange and terrible form of madness. I looked at him. You must have suffered mightily all those years ago to be driven to such a strange and terrible course of study.
I did. I told you. And yet all study is worthwhile, observing things and trying to understand their hidden patterns. Medical books alone can become binds and fetters, as can the Bible in the wrong hands.
Do you think you understand the pattern of this killer's mind? He shook his head.
No, it's too dark and too strange. With Adam Kite, I'm hopeful that I will come to understand, but this man, no.
Again I saw how his thin face was lined with pain.
You suffer now too, don't you?
We all suffer, Matthew. We have to find our own ways through with God's help.
He forced a smile.
I thought young Piers acquitted himself bravely today. He volunteered to come with me, volunteered to go up on that wall with Barak. You see, you had him wrong.
I saw him smile as Minnie Kite railed at Shorms. He's not someone you should invest so heavily in.
He will learn compassion.
I didn't argue with him then. Yet I doubted what he said was possible. But it also seemed to me then that there was little hope in the world, and a man shouldn't be blamed for clinging on to that which he could find.
Chapter 21.